man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, If You Want Anyway, and we're about to get started.
Never do that again.
great theme song.
Today, I'm joined by producer and film festivals programmer, Drea Clark. What is good?
Thank you for asking. You guys, not to get all literary, but what's good with me is a book.
Ooh.
Not just a book, a nonfiction book,
ooh,
which are the kind that smart people read. It is called The Five, The Untold Lives of the Women Killed by Jack the Ripper by Hallie Rubenhold. And it was recommended to me, and I got it on my Libby app, my little library
nice.
Digital
ooh.
App, and just finished it. It is so interesting. It's obviously about the untold lives of the five women killed by Jack the Ripper, or the ones that were attributed to him. There's always been the idea that he probably killed more. But what's great about it is the author did all of this research and dug into their lives, like from birth till their death, and like gives a full account of them as women and people in the world. And this is the first time they were really examined, and it's been 130 years since these murders. So it's this sort of really interesting insight to the disgusting conditions of London at that time, but also how we look at history and who is deemed worthy of having their story told and what assumptions were erroneously made about them because of their place in history and have just always stood and are now kind of part of the common knowledge. Anyway, it's a great read, and it's very interesting and engaging, and I highly recommend it. And that's what's good with me. Plus, I get to look super smart, even though I guess I'm reading on my phone most of the time, so I just look like a jerk like everybody else.
She's just texting, and she's so focused.
What a long text.
We are also joined by film reviews editor at The Wrap, Alonzo Duralde. What is good? Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm sorry. That's the name of the show. It's called I'm Sorry. It stars the very funny Andrea Savage. And I am a fan of hers. And when the show started on True TV, I was all excited about it. And then my TiVo, for some reason, was on like Pacific time, and the TiVo schedule was on Eastern time or something. All I know is that every time I tried the TiVo I'm Sorry, I got Impractical Jokers and stuff. And that's just not a place you want to be.
But it is a joke. It was impractical.
On me, I guess. Anyway, so I just, you know, as you do, these it kind of slipped by me. Well, on the plane, they had like six episodes of I'm Sorry on Delta. And I watched them, and they're hilarious. And Andrea Savage is a genius. And so season one is on Netflix, but I think they're on like season four. So hopefully more will come to Netflix, or you can track them down in other places. But yeah, I have been, you know, among the many shows I have missed over the last decade or so. I'm Sorry. It's really funny. You should check it out.
Ooh.
I've also missed that, and I've also been interested in it. And someone else just recommended that to me this week.
Well, there you go.
There you go. Well, listen, if both you and my friend said it, it's
gotta
count.
Just me, yeah. No. But yes, there's a consensus now. If
it
was good.
Well, kid bueno. Is that even right?
No. What, you just said iffy. How good?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, iffy. How good?
Well, you know, what's good with me is a couple of friends of mine have been working on this movie based off of this little web series, and they just announced that it's going to be launching on Netflix. It's the Between Two Ferns movie. Mm. I'm real excited to check that out, see how they made it a movie. Like, that's just my first question is, how is this a movie? There is a trailer. I'm not going to watch it because, I like to go in blind.
Sure.
It's ever since I accidentally done it, like years ago, I'm like, no, this is truly the only way, because there's so many times like a movie's trailer just sells it so poorly that you just go in and you're just like, what? See, I would not have seen this if I, you know.
Or it gives away all the good stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, the trailer is the movie they want to sell you, not the movie that they actually made.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. There's too much Act Three in trailers nowadays. Like, get that out of there.
A friend of mine on Twitter said recently, the only thing you can learn from a trailer is who's in it and how the movie was shot. Like, what the cinematography looks like. That's it.
Like, that's all we need.
Everything else is a crapshoot.
Yeah. Well, today's shows, we're talking about the once record-breaking film Avatar. Of course, we'll be taking a call from the Who Shot line. And as always, we'll be ending with our staff picks. But first, it's time for our new segment called Itadick, short for Is This Important and Do I Care? Each of us will read a new segment and answer the question, is this important and do I care?
You know you want to do this one.
Oh, yeah. You know I... Oh, you know. So it's you know, it's been a long time coming. It's been quiet on the nerd front for much too long. So, of course, the Joker had to pop up and let us know he's still a thing. Last week, the hotly anticipated DC film Joker starring Joaquin Phoenix premiered at the Venice Film Festival. Shout out to Alonzo. The film became something of a lightning rod of criticism. Forbes and Empire gave the film rave reviews, while Vanity Fair's Richard Lawson said the film may be irresponsible propaganda for the very men it pathologizes. Times' Stephanie Zacharick said of the director Todd Phillips, he may want us to think he's given us a movie all about the emptiness of our culture, but really, he's just offering a prime example of it. Burn. And discussions online have been very passionate, to say the very least. And some have called the film potentially dangerous. Is this important? Do you care?
Well, I've seen it.
Yeah.
I was there. Yeah. I was not at the public screening with the 8-minute alleged standing ovation or whatever. No, but I saw the movie. I mean, we'll get into it. I'm sure we're going to do a whole episode about it. But I gave it a, you know, mixed review. Yeah. I think there are things about it that are interesting and that are well crafted. There are some good performances. I think Joaquin Phoenix is doing what was asked of him and doing a thing that fits for the movie. Whether or not what he's doing is your cup of tea is obviously going to be, you know, your own thing. I've certainly been dealing with a lot of blowback on Twitter who I'm sure didn't even read the review but are just for mad sure. that I gave it a green splat on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
Because we all... there's a longer conversation to be had about this. But I read comics as a kid partially as a way to not have to deal with sports.
Yeah.
And now people treat corporate-owned comic book properties like their sports team.
Ooh, nice.
And
yeah.
So now, you know, and so in the same way that whether the New York Yankees win or lose doesn't really impact your life, but a lot of people carry it around like it does, the fact that, like, DC movies versus Marvel movies and which ones get the better reviews and which ones make more money means way too much to people who have nothing to do with the making or distributing or profiting off of these projects. And they're all on my Twitter feed this week, and I wish they would go away.
Preach!
Oh, man, yeah. The DC has the notorious... bad fan base. Like they it's just known, and it kind of has been this I think that was the best analogy of sports. They are the Browns fans of movies, so they have
a
lot
Browns
to say.
The underdogs, because honestly, yeah. My read on it, that's my sports knowledge. Browns are they a big team? Is that a? But I do think the DC fans see themselves as underdogs. They see themselves as like, I think they've enjoyed Marvel's dominance in that area because it gives them more to like complain about.
Oh yeah, and they have the attitude of a like 12-year-old alternative kid, because now they've taken on the failures of DC as a personality of like they're like, oh, you know, you just don't get it. And it was like, no, we get it, you know. And what's funny to me is I can't wait for a wide release, because I am personally thinking that, and you would be the one who would know if this is true or not, but to me it feels like, based on everything I've seen about the Joker, is that the regular base is going to just think it's too artsy. Like, they're going to, or does it lean into the...
It's a Todd Phillips movie. Let's not kid ourselves. It is a Todd Phillips movie that is clearly inspired by several Martin Scorsese movies. Like, my original headline for The Wrap, which, alas, they changed, was Joaquin Phoenix is the Travis Bickle of Rupert Pupkins.
Stop it.
Because
I hope people Google that to know how good that is.
Because it is so, like, Taxi Driver meets King of Comedy. to the extent that Robert De Niro plays a successful Johnny Carson-esque talk show host in the film.
Oh, wow.
Like, it is, they're not even hiding it.
My thing, yeah, I think it's important because it's part of our zeitgeist. Man, I could not care less about this movie. Yeah. I wouldn't see it unless, I mean, I assume we're going to see it to talk about it. I would not see it on my own. I don't need to see movies about a disenfranchised white dude who turns to violence as a solution. Like, oh, great. Love to see that. Like,
One person has already referred to it as falling clown.
Yeah, I mean,
oh, that's gorgeous.
Also, the fact of the matter and why, like, just me as a nerd has never been interested in this movie is the beauty of the Joker was that he never had an origin story.
Exactly.
That was the greatest part of Heath Ledger's character is the fact that he kept making
lying
it up.
About it, yeah.
And the comics, well, that was a tradition for years.
Exactly.
They would always switch it up, you know, because...
And that's what's, you know, beautiful about the Joker because it's this... You don't need a reason to be evil. And that is the character Joker. He's chaos. So the moment you give him this incel-esque backstory, and that's why it's chaos, it, you know, I also want, like, I try and take my foot off the pedal of, like, sensationalizing this, but it does kind of lean towards, like, yeah, no, it is cool to just be chaotic because you didn't get what you wanted. I don't think that it's completely, you know, radicalizing, you know, that base, but I'm sure it doesn't help.
Yeah, I'm not going to be one of those people with a megaphone who's like, oh, this movie's so dangerous. It's going to inspire copycats. Because that's a thing they like to trot out for video games all this other stuff. And it's you know, it's no, that's not the issue here. But yeah, it is certainly, I think, stoking a certain awful corner of the conversation in its own way. But... you know, that in and of itself, again, not a terrible thing. I just think the movie itself is just sort of, it just borrows from a lot of other sources, and it's ultimately, it doesn't really come down on anything. I mean, in my review, I said, like, this is the kind of movie that, like, political pundits of all stripes will find, like, a scene or a line about, you know, just sort of, that's going to back up what they really think that the movie is about and how it agrees with them. But I think ultimately that just means that it's not about anything.
Yeah.
The Crazy Rich Asians co-writer has just exited the sequel. TV writer Adele Lim, who co-wrote the 2018 film with veteran screenwriter Peter Chiarelli, and she's... done some great TV stuff and also has just been signed to do that, the Disney, the Raya and the Dragon. So,
Yeah. It was just announced. Yeah. We had to write Raya and the Dragon.
Yeah. Thank you for getting the name right.
Yeah.
And so for the sequel films, Chiarelli was offered payment in the range of $800,000 to $1 million. And Lim, the co-writer, other writer, was only offered around $110,000. Warner's explained to Lim's reps that the quotes are industry standard, established ranges based on experience, and that making an exception would set a troubling precedent in the business. Lim walked away from the project last fall, and for months, Color Force Studio, who produced, has been looking for another writer of Asian descent to take her place. They have failed so far, so now they've offered her a salary closer to Peter Chiarelli. And incidentally, this was my favorite part of it, is she said that he has had her back the whole time.
Yeah.
He also offered to split his salary with Lim, but she walked away saying, "Pete has been nothing but incredibly gracious, but what I make shouldn't be dependent on the generosity of the white guy writer. Is this important? Do you care?"
So important.
Right. Is this just in our wheelhouse or what? Yeah.
Well, yeah. Okay. There was in the article, the quote that really struck me was where she talked about how the studio tries to pay you based on your sort of level of experience and what you've done. And it's like, yeah, what she's done includes Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, Macaulay Culkin got $100,000 for Home Alone, but then he got $4 million for Home Alone too.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you want to keep the Asian woman who co-wrote Crazy Rich Asians on the team.
And it's a film that had, like, the original Crazy Rich Asians was like a $30 million budget and has amassed more than $200 million something at this point. Like,
yes.
You really think a piece of that should not be going to keep this? It's insulting that they offered that in the first place. It's also insulting, this whole idea of industry precedent is a very standard tactic when you're negotiating rates. And it's such bullshit because it's obviously protective on the studio side. But the idea there of them, it's beyond insulting, of coming back and being like, you did a great job. You're aware of our success. We'd like to give you this paltry effing amount.
But here's the thing, and here's why this is complete bullshit in 2 points. One is this, so it's
he's
the
bring it down just to 2 points.
Yeah, so the industry. So it's the industry standard, right? So if we were to say, I don't know, ask them, all right, well, across the board, let's see how much you've paid, you know, your writers. They would say, no, that's a breach of privacy. So then that negates the fact of this setting a troubling precedent, because if you won't even tell people what you're paying other writers, then
why would you know?
Yeah. This is like so just my shit right now, mostly because, you know, I'm in a comedy group, White Women, and we're all TV writers. And something we've discussed is the kind of like drop off in the growth of writers of color. Hmm. Which is simply because you have the diversity scholarship in your studios paying them for all the lower level writing positions. But once it gets to higher level, then the producers have to pay you. They have to pay you real money. And for some reason, that's when writers fall off. Unless, of course, you probably wrote for, I don't know, the Lampoon or something. You know, then you're going to get, I love that shade tweet of the one that was going around that was like Harvard Lampoon writers hiring themselves, because there is no real president of comedy beyond just humor sensibility. So
if you're twofer from 30 Rock,
yeah, and it's so wild to see things like this where it's like if this wasn't Crazy Rich Asians, if this was any other movie and it was a white writer, we know they would have got a huge pay bump. You know, like that's how we perceive it works, and that's how I imagine it works in most cases. But to fall back on the studio like that, it just shows that they're always trying to screw you over, and it kind of negates that idea of like, if the best, when you break through, you'll make it. It's like, no, they're still going to try.
You keep moving the goalposts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, this is the same kind of Hollywood accounting where, like, you know, when Art Buchwald sued Paramount because they had taken his idea for Coming to America, the studio was somehow able to prove that the movie had never made a profit.
Amazing.
Coming to America.
No one's ever heard of it because it never made a profit.
Yeah.
I do think the most important takeaway from this is that Adele Lim drew the fucking line.
Yeah.
She was like, no, I'm not interested. I'm a good writer. I have this whole other thing going on now. I'm not going to be treated like this. Because if they're doing that to just her, like, not a lot of people are in the place that she's in. The fact that this now has any traction as a story is entirely because of her being like, I won't do it.
Yeah, to say no and to talk about it in public.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. We got spicy right there. But now we're going to take a break. But when we come back, we'll be talking about Avatar. And just as soon as we... But when we come back, we'll be talking about Avatar just as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on Maximum Fun.
Macho Man to the top rope. The flying elbow. The cover. We've got a new champion!
We're here with Macho Man Randy Savage after his big win to become the new world champion. What are you going to do now, Match?
I'm going to go listen to the newest episode of the Tights and Fights podcast, oh yeah.
Tell us more about this podcast.
It's the podcast of power, too sweet to be sour, funky like a monkey, woke discussions, man, and jokes about wrestlers' fashion choices, myself excluded, yeah.
I can't wait to listen.
Neither can I. You can find it Thursdays on Maximum Fun. Oh, yeah, dig it.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway. In the studio with me are
Drea Clark,
Alonzo Duralde.
And today we're talking about Avatar. And Drea, since you chose this film for us to talk about today, why don't you give us a synopsis?
I do think most of the world probably knows what this movie's about. It does take some of the pressure off doing the old synopsis.
Spoilers.
This movie follows Jake Sully a recently wounded Marine who has lost the use of his legs and is real despondent. He is shipped to a faraway planet where he takes over the mission started by his twin brother, who's thankfully his genomes match. And he is quickly inserted into the body of a Na'vi soldier, fledgling, whatever guy, and part of this scientific experiment that also has a military invasion in with it. He befriends the Na'vi, one of them in particular, played by Zoe Saldana. And I like the questioning of this again, 10 years old. And yes, you guys, it is not super copacetic. I don't know if you knew that. War is a coming.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, he basically has to choose between the humans and the Na'vi. And that's Avatar.
I want to try a synopsis.
Are you going to read the Fern Gully synopsis?
Jake Sully develops a relationship with a band of Na'vi. Attracted by the simplicity of their lifestyle, he chooses to leave his former life behind to be with them. Having observed them, they give him the name Dances with Wolves. Soon, he is a welcomed member of the tribe and falls in love with a Na'vi who has been raised in the tribe. Tragedy results when the other soldiers arrive with designs on the land.
Yes. Well, the soldiers came with them, but there are many, many that follow this.
Drea, why'd you pick this film?
So I saw this film when it came out in the theaters 10 years ago, and I remember thinking at the time, like, oh, this looks great and is completely forgettable as a story. I've not seen it since then. It comes on TV every once in a while, and I'm like, huh, there's never a time where I'm like, oh, it's this scene. Like, yeah. I never am like, oh, fun, I'll just watch this bit, which I do with other films that pop up that way. And I remember acutely Alonzo brought up when they announced the 4 sequels for this film, which will be coming out 2021 through 2027, you made this great point of a film that has made the intense box office that this film has, that has almost zero cultural resonance, that, yeah, you know, people don't dress up like the Na'vi. There's not like a cosplay element that's big. There's not fan fiction. There's not lines. It's not been absorbed. No one parodies moments from this.
There's no metaphor in political op-eds about it.
Yeah. You know. They don't flash back to it, which is interesting because they're in rewatching it. So again, I rewatched it for this and I was like, oh, this seems like a film that would have some really interesting conversation points to revisit 10 years later, to look both at the film and also the sort of lack of cultural resonance.
Yeah.
Because that's fascinating to me. And in rewatching it, like, again, the white savior stuff is pretty apparent from the beginning. Oh, yeah. You're either bothered by it or you don't notice it at all, which is what I think most people do. But yeah, I'm like, oh no, there's so much in here, like, to dig into.
Oh yeah, no, that's what's been fun for me, because, like, you know, I definitely, like, started off the movie just immediate red flags watching it with my, like, 2019.
And when's
Wolf
the last
brain.
Time you saw it?
Oh, the same thing in theaters,
yeah,
10 years
okay.
ago. And, you know, like, and I remember I didn't like it back then either. I was just like, and I was doing the whole, this bit I just did carried over from 10 years ago of being like, this is just Dancing with Wolves. And
own your material.
Yeah, I remember my, like, friend's boyfriend who was in film school her and her boyfriend were so mad at me because they were like, this movie is gonna change cinema and it's great. And I'd love to revisit that conversation, you know,
well,
today.
They said that everything was in fucking 3D for the next 3 years.
Well, what was interesting was rewatching it and, like, kind of seeing, I can understand why it gross so much almost through watching it, and some reasons are good, some reasons are bad. Just a quick TLDR, the good reasons is James Cameron is James Cameron and he's building a beautiful world and it's fun to watch, but everyone feels like a caricature. Like, the main antagonist feels like someone I played, a boss I fought in a video game, like, 20 years ago. Like, just so, just right, like, limp dick scientist. I was like, we're going that hard. And then you have, like, the super nerd who's mad at the jock who's, like, it was
there are,
like.
Yeah, there are no shades of gray
it
here.
It was, like, straight up every archetype. But I think that gives it more global appeal, because if you're, like, in a country that doesn't speak English and you're watching this like movie that's supposed to be this 2-hour and 45-minute film that's supposed to be super deep, but they have these like very clear archetypes.
Yeah.
You don't need to understand what they're saying. And I think that added to the draw.
That's the thing. James Cameron is James Cameron.
Yeah.
So he does create this amazing world, and he does like have this amazing eye for visual effects, and this movie moved visual effects forward in the way that like The Matrix did. But James Cameron is a terrible writer. Like,
agreed.
It's worth remembering that the year that Titanic swept the Oscars, the Academy Awards could not get enough Titanic. Best screenplay, no nomination. Like, it's I think that's part of why this movie has no cultural footprint. I just watched it this morning and I couldn't quote a single line to you.
I do not know the lead female character's name.
Sure,
you watched it this morning.
Yeah.
Like,
exactly. It just slides right off your brain. And I mean, I will say I didn't hate it when I saw it 10 years ago, because this is one of those movies where the experience of seeing it in a theater in 3D was extraordinary. Like, it is one of the rare times in a movie like this where I would have to occasionally sort of blink and remind myself, oh, wait, this is a movie. Like, I felt so immersed in the sounds and the lushness of that planet. But boy, you watch it on TV and you're just stuck with that script and those characters and Sigourney Weaver coming out of the pod and immediately demanding a cigarette in the most like contrivy sort of way.
Why am I waiting for a cigarette? No, I agree. The visuals are stupendous, and it was that kind of immersive quality. The only cultural moment I remember at the time was, do you remember people were getting depressed because they couldn't go to Pandora? It was probably one small story, so it got blown up. But that was it, the idea of people being so excited about this other world. So, and that's completely a credit to the visual arts of this movie, like what it's doing, the world building it's doing. The other thing I found fascinating about it, especially with a few years distance, the politics of this movie are incredible, because on the surface, you're like, oh, it's super anti-military, super anti-imperialism. The whole thing is about
corporatism.
It's like how colonialism is just terrible and wreaks havoc, and that we go in blind and stomp on things and we don't look at the nuances of another culture. And yet, like, that's done through the lens of someone who, to me, if you asked him now about the idea of like, oh, your lead character is a white man who's in the body of this other race, this other culture, creature, whatever it is, aliens, and they have to defer to him because he can do things none of them are capable of.
Yeah, I say, it's not just that he learns their ways. He's better at their ways than they are.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is the sci-fi soul man.
Yeah.
Sci-fi soul man. But that's it, right? Like, how can you be like anti-colonialism if you're saying like, I mean, we get it. Like, the white guy would do it better, but we shouldn't you guys.
Yeah.
Like, the hubris of that shocked me.
There's so much to unpack, because one, you have this idea that like this movie is saying that we would do the Trail of Tears twice. Like we would just forget and do it again.
And we have. I mean, yeah.
I was like, look what we did
with Hawaii and Vietnam and all these places.
This was when Iraq was like fully in the news every day when this came out. Yeah.
And then like also like I like that the scientists are so like they love the Na'vi so much. They're so into it, yet they don't They haven't built any type of resistance to try and foil these because for all intents and purposes, these military guys are idiots. Like, I don't see why these scientists haven't outsmarted them and sent them on some like hellscape part of the planet to die. Because it really like he's built these dumb idiots who still who are like, yeah, we gotta kill, destroy, and somehow the scientists can't keep up against them. And then it was interesting because there was this idea of like the Na'vi are these crazy, unstoppable, you know, race of aliens until we don't need them to be, you know, until we get to the third act and we need to raise their town. Then all of their tactics for some reason now don't work
on
us because now we know the architecture of their tree.
Well, there were small things. There's discrepancies in here that made me, I'm like, oh, don't make me defend the military. But in the smallest, like, I think what you're saying of him having these real stereotypical characters, and part of it is, yes, I do think that also lends to the fact that, like, ultimately the global box office for it accounted for, like, 72-73% of the immense fortune that it's raised. But it is that kind of thing of, like, oh, the broader strokes you make, the easier it is to translate.
Yeah.
Like, more than just translate. But there were a few things I'm like, oh, he talked about, like, he sent the cast to Hawaii to get used to the idea of being in a rainforest so that when we were there shooting in front of a green screen, they could, like, emulate that. Or it's like in, you know, that he had all of these, like, flora and fauna professors so that in the creating language, like, he spends all of this time doing all this. And yet, his main, like, my brother is in the military and he's active in the military. And the idea of we meet this guy who, A, the very second he's put into the body of the Na'vi, he immediately stops obeying orders. And I'm like, yeah, that guy's not a soldier. Like, you're not in the military. Like, literally, that's all they train you to do is listen. Like, no, he's going to sit there till you tell him to move.
Yeah.
And then that he's also someone who, not just the disregarding orders, but that the other, the Marines around him, when we first see him, see this clearly, like, wounded in combat, paralyzed veteran wheel out of a military thing. And then, like, three other
dicks.
Marines are like, oh, look at this cripple. And you're like, that's not how.
Yeah.
Like, there's plenty of stuff to say about the military, but like them being loyal to their fallen comrades is not one of them.
What you were saying though before about, like, you know, let's do the Trail of Tears again. The movie goes out of its way to remind you that they're all veterans now working for this corporation.
True.
Because heaven forbid you make a movie where the government wants to launch genocide so that they can strip the natural resources. Heaven knows we would never do that. We wouldn't want audiences to have to think about that for a second.
So
instead, we're going to go back to the alien formula and make it about the bad corporation.
Except for, it is so thinly veiled. Again, I just rewatched it and was like, oh, yeah, I guess they were. It's so, I mean, to me, it's such a clear, like, no, they're all of American accents. Those are American soldiers.
They've all got the buzz
cuts. That's American capitalism.
Yeah.
Our boy Giovanni Ribisi being like, yeah, I'll play the bad guy. How bad you want me to be? Like, you want bad guy? I'll give you bad guy.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how bad?
Can I grease my hair? What do you want from me?
Let's also step back to this, you know, the lauded, you know,
special effects?
Not special effects,
visual effects,
but all the, like the Hawaii things were like that he went to linguist to deliver this language. And I remember watching this, and I was like, oh, I know why 21-year-old Iffy was really annoyed by this. These are just fucking African accents. What do you mean? You went to a linguist to learn how to do this fake language in an African accent. It's very African tribal. It's very truly offensive when you really, like, think of.
Interesting.
I was like, this is where, because it's very African. Like, it's like the inflection is almost because, like I figured the formula for the Wakandan, which is a very wispy African accent. And this one, it was like, it like, they definitely, like, you could tell they had linguists because they definitely put, like, an inflection I can't quite figure out, but the base is still African. And then when you think of, like, I think those were, like, all black. Zoe Saldana.
I was going to say, there's one black scientist who speaks, and there's Michelle Rodriguez.
Yeah.
But then all the Na'vi are, like, CCH Pounder and Laz Alonso and Zoe Saldana. And I also want to point out real quick, just because I've read a lot of critics talk about The way films handle disability. And
I wanted to touch on that too.
Yeah, the idea that, like, you know, he's a schlub in a wheelchair, but boy, put him in that able body, you know, Na'vi avatar, and bam, we got a hero, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought about that a lot too, because recently, you know, I have a lot of friends who, like, spoke out on, like, you know, how disability is viewed in cyberpunk, and how it's like this, like, oh, isn't it going to be so much better in the future when you could just fix your body and not, and that kind of, like, made me take a, because it's something I never considered, but, like, now kind of, like, having that kind of POV in my brain when I watch this, it is kind of like the idea of, like, he's like, I just need to get out this wheelchair, like, this is the only thing holding me back, you know, and it's like, no.
And it's because the rest of it lacks any nuance. There is, of course, an argument to be made for someone who is newly paralyzed, newly in a wheelchair. And then also the world they're in, they've told us immediately that A, he's paralyzed, but B, he can be fixed. He just doesn't have the money for
it yet.
So there would be a really interesting character study of that, of is he asking himself about that thing? Or if Jake Sully as a character had asked himself about, like, how people would, if, you know, he, there's, like, this other guy who's clearly sort of the leader of this tribe, and he asks him to be his partner, but he doesn't defer to him at all, ever. Mm-hmm. There's so much in this movie, you guys.
Yeah.
Shall we rank?
Yes.
Sure. You know, I would say only screen it.
That's the same thing I was going
to
say.
Unfortunately, Disney apparently is now flexing their thing to Fox titles where they're not going to let them out to repertory theaters.
Wow,
so you may never get to. But if they're smart, and I know you're listening, Disney Brain Trust, you better re-release Avatar in 3D before those sequels come out to remind people why they liked this movie in the first place. Because if they just watch it on TV the way we all did, it's not going to go so well.
Yeah. I would also pick our new category of screen it only, and I'm interested to see. I'll definitely see at least the first sequel and see how that goes. I would love for them to take the world building and beauty of this and maybe mix it up. Maybe not such a heteronormative story. Mm. Maybe not such a patriarchal society. There's possibility there, but it looks great.
Yeah, I'm gonna say screen it only, and also, like, I want to touch on that patriarchal society thing, because I want just a quick nod on that, because, you know, anytime, you know, there's a tinge of, like, tribalness, it always seems to be very patriarchal. But there are a lot of tribes that have women as leaders, because lot of tribes have the belief that women can create life, so they should be the ones leading, and it is funny that that's the one thing they like to borrow from us in African tribes, is this, is the idea of the quote-unquote primitiveness, and never the, like, very progressive ideas that are always stepped over, because God forbid, you know, we enter a tribe ran by women.
Not in a movie directed by a man, you won't.
But yeah, screen only, and I will say, you know, yeah, looking back, it didn't hold up the same, but it was, like, watching it, I was like, in a theater, I can see why in 2009, before you had all the Netflixes, Hulus, Disney Pluses, anything you want to watch, whenever you want to watch, and you had, like...
This was an event.
Exactly. This was, like, the first kind of viral thing you couldn't just see on your phone. You had to go.
Yeah.
So this was the Bird Box of 2009. and I mean that in more ways than one. We'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Friendship is tough, especially when you're constantly slaying carnivorous hell beasts bent on your destruction.
Hey, make sure to clean the tub. I might actually need to shower today.
Oh, don't give me that. You've been wearing the same pair of track pants since Tuesday. I mean, they still have the size sticker on the leg.
Yeah, they do. Well, still, I was thinking today might be the day.
Yeah. Oh, it's still alive! Kill it!
I don't have any weapons!
Get it with the shower head!
Shit. My burrito got some gunk on it.
But that's just Fairhaven. We make it work. Bubble, the sci-fi comedy from MaximumFun.org. Just open your podcast app and search for Bubble.
Welcome back to Who Shot You? I'm your host, Ify Wadiwe, and in the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duralde.
Drea Clark.
And now it's time to answer a call from the Who Shot line. Casey, play that call.
Hi. So this is Siri calling from Seattle, and I'm just looking for some hot movie recommendations. So I love, like, Dirty Dancing, Havana Nights, and I just want some, like, uncomplicated, sexy movies. Or some recommendations. So, yeah, I'd love if you can suggest something for us. Thanks.
I got to say off the top, love the energy of this call. I love... Everyone knows horny is my brand, and I'm glad it's infiltrated into the Who Shot line.
Havana Nights, bold choice.
I know that Havana Nights is a great example. I also like that it ended with an for us, and I was like, ooh, there's like a silent partner just back there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Also
yeah.
Wondering, what are we going to pick?
He's tapping like, mention me, please. Oh, man, I'm so hyped for this. Y'all have detailed ones, so I'll go off with my anecdotal pick, and because mine I haven't seen. The way I found it was there was a period of time where I didn't have, like, my computer was on the fritz and I only had Netflix, so I was searching for the hottest movies on Netflix for personal reasons, and this one came up, and they removed it from streaming.
Before it was too hot for TV?
Yeah.
Too hot for Netflix?
And it was the 2000 film Cheeky by Tinto Brass, described as a sex comedy. And I remember because I was like, I got to find this movie because the cover is a butt. Like, it was like someone's skirt going up and it was a butt. And I was like, I got to find this. Netflix deleted it. Have either of you seen it?
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it. You will be very excited about the new movie from the guy that did Blue is the Warmest Color, though, that played at Cannes this year, because it's all butts, apparently.
Oh yes. That's...
Butts as far as the eye can see?
Yeah.
First off, Ify, never change. He was like, ooh, I like this category. Here's the thing. I've not seen this movie, but I'm a visual learner.
I only saw, like, the intro, and, like, she's, like, going through the city, and she, like, the thing is, like, she has a nice butt. But, like, I guess this was before, like, Pornhub allowed you to put, like, a movie-length movie.
Oh, my God.
Because that's where I had to go to see it. Nowhere else had it.
And nothing I was like, sexier than the thing you can't quite make
that's
out.
True. Well, that's true. Well, that's part of it, isn't it?
As I could, because I was able to order, because this was still when it was packaged with ordering the DVDs, and I was like, I know that I'm going to have my laptop by the time the DVD gets here, and I'm going to just forget about it. And also, like, I don't need Netflix knowing what I'm up to.
Oh my God.
Because you're so discreet otherwise.
So, yes. I will never sit in a box and talk on a microphone about this stuff,
man.
Be released to the public.
Yeah.
I think Alonzo and I have some movies we've seen.
Yes. Yeah, we'll go figure. I have a lot of... I was thinking more about sexy moments than movies
entirely.
That's
a big thing. Mine came up with that as well, because I was thinking of, like, ooh, this bit, but,
like,
the whole thing isn't,
like,
necessarily.
Like, when Grace Kelly first appears in Rear Window, when she, like, leans in and draws into focus... Look, not my team, but I gasped in the theater. I was like, whoa, okay. Like, that moment I just remember being really sexy. I'm a big fan of Henry and June, which has quite a few sexy moments. But one of the best ones is there's a scene where a nice nin, played by Maria de Medeiros, and her husband, played by Richard E. Grant, go to a bordello, and they want to watch two women make love. And the two women at first do so in a very kind of aggressive, kind of masculine way. And Anaisin says, no, like two women or like be feminine, whatever. And then they start, like, doing it lady style. And again,
Jesus.
Not my jam. And I was like, wow, can we have some more AC in this theater?
You just went back to back with the quotes, doing it lady style and not my jam.
Look.
I'm treasuring that.
I know where my bagel is buttered, all right?
Speaking of where your bagel's buttered, E2 Mama Tambien.
There we go.
Is always something that it has it's sexual, the whole thing of it. It's not necessarily like structured like a porn, so it's sensual encounter after sensual encounter, but it's rife with it. Like the whole, it's a very evocative film. And when they do get busy, it's so tangible and sweaty and like passionate.
I got a good double feature for that one.
Yes.
Jamón Jamón.
Ooh.
I think it's Penelope Cruz's first movie.
See.
And she and Javier Bardem are both in it years before they got married. And like one of the running plots of the movie is about like this woman who owns a jeans company and is casting models and is basically just like checking out dudes' bulges. And like, it's just, it is, there is so much in this movie that is just like, people are either having sex or they're about to have sex or they're thinking about it or talking about it. And there's a lot of paella.
Yeah. Oh, that's, it goes well with sex.
Yeah.
I would put, I think The Handmaiden is one of the hottest movies I've seen in the last few years. It's a really interesting narrative structure. It's based on a book called The Fingersmith, which is just, you know, quality lesbian classic. And
it is.
Yeah, and it truly is. And The Handmaiden is so sexy in such, like, for actual sex scenes, but then in unexpected ways, it's very sexually charged. And a movie that has minimal actual sex scenes, but I find Secretary... I loved Secretary. I think it's a movie about a woman basically learning her own kink and learning, and he does as well. Like both the partner she ends up with, who's played by James Spader, and the woman's played by Maggie Gyllenhaal. And it's just like it's a different avenue into sexuality, but it's spicy. I think it's a spicy view.
Okay, I got some.
There's a solid spank. You gotta enjoy it. Just a well executed.
If we're
spank.
Talking spanks, then The Secretary. Am I remembering that right?
She literally just described Secretary, Mr. on the phone.
Well, because I was okay. Oh my gosh, that's so funny. Because I was like deep into because I wanted to get this name right, but I did see one that was sexy. By the Wachowskis, Bound.
I was just going to bring up Bound, yes.
Gotcha first. That was like, oh man, and that one was when I kind of cripped in the middle. My roommate was watching, and I was like, well, what are we watching here? And I had to sit down, and then it was like this cool, like, dope story. And then it reminded me of when we were saying, like, you should support all of the dope things the Wachowskis doing so they don't have to do another Matrix.
Exactly. Well, they hired Susie Bright, who was a very well-known lesbian sexpert, to sort of, you know, kind of work with them on the scene and choreograph it. And ask any lesbian, and they'll tell you, super hot, but no one wears those fingernails.
Yeah. That's a lie. I know a professional lesbian, a married lesbian, who every time I see her, I'm like, your wife's got to be pissed, man.
I feel like I need to throw some gay movies in.
Yes.
For sure, the British film Weekend.
That was on my list.
Yeah, which I think is super hot.
Dreamy,
From the sort of like pickup encounter to then the actual getting to know you and then the continuing to have sex
because it's
while
both,
getting to know you.
It's these two beautiful men, British men, and there's a clock, like, so there's an urgency to it, but also there's the sexiness of like the intellectual, like, connection they're making, balancing out their hot, like, hooking up. Oh, that's great.
And then as far as like sexy moments, the, you know, between dudes, two Stephen Frears movies come to mind. My Beautiful Laundrette, there's that incredible moment where Daniel Day-Lewis is hugging his Pakistani friend in front of Daniel Day-Lewis's gang of skinheads, and unbeknownst to the skinheads, because he's got his back to them, he licks his neck. Which is closeted me in college, lost his mind over that one. And then in Prick Up Your Ears, where like Joe Orton is just picking up dudes in the street and going into like public restrooms with them. Again, closeted me in college. I was like, what am I even looking at?
I think a woman who enjoyed Dirty Dancing Havana Nights would enjoy the erotic thriller of Unfaithful.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's Diane Lane and Olivier Martinez. And who's
who's the husband?
Oops, sorry, husband. I forgot you because of Olivier Martinez.
Is it Campbell Scott?
I don't think so.
No, I forget.
But either way, there's some real hotness, real hot, sweaty hotness in that.
And again, a double bill with Adrian Lyne's 9.5 Weeks.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Which is absurd for much of it, but there are moments where you're like, okay, I can see where there's like
triple bill with body heat.
Someone's finding this hot. Well, yeah, no, body heat.
So
that's
Siri
a whole other film.
And her for us,
yeah,
partner.
Whoever or partners,
partners. Yeah, don't let me limit you. Yeah,
hope
you
know, these help.
So we're gonna leave Monster Ball sitting on the sitting on floor. We're gonna leave. Let me see.
That one's tricky because there's you know so much violence.
Yeah. It takes a while. It's sad. That's why I was thinking about like. Yeah, some sexy scenes are like, there's too much sad stuff.
As you say, it's
it.
Imbued with tragedy, yeah, yeah, that film. It's a tough call.
Yeah. Thank you to everyone who has called in. We've gotten a ton of great calls in the past couple of weeks, so please keep it up. And the number to the Who Shot line is WSY-803-1664. That was WSY-803-1664.
Wait, is it Richard Gere?
Yes!
Richard Gere is the husband in Unfaithful.
I remember that movie then. Okay. Yeah. Now it's time for our staff picks. It could be any movie in theaters, streaming, what have you. Alonzo, why don't you start?
Sure. So this is a documentary that is already showing in Texas. It's going to open in New York this week, and it opens in L.A. next week, I think. It premiered at Sundance this year. It's called Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins. And as somebody who lived in Texas for a while in the 80s and 90s, I can attest to how essential Molly Ivins was to the political discourse of the time, because she did not suffer fools. She called things out as they were, and she was hilarious while doing it. In fact, my first job after college, my first real job, was at the Dallas Times Herald, which was her base newspaper, although she was in the Austin bureau. And I actually wrote her an inter-office fan letter once. I never heard back from her, but whatever. Anyway, she was amazing. And this film is, it is mostly your kind of traditional Talking Heads documentary, but the stuff that she says and the vintage interviews that they find with her are so entertaining. And so much of what she has to say about the nature of politics and political corruption and power and, you know, misuse of that power remains all too relevant. It's a movie we're checking out. Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins.
All right. What about you, Drew?
Mine is also a film from this year's Sundance. It is called Ms. Purple. It's directed by Justin Chan, who did Gook like 2 years ago. Okay. But is known, speaking of Kristen Stewart, is known to many because he played one of the high school boys in the Twilight series.
Oh, did he?
Yes, that in the like goofy town boys that she hung out
like
with.
Like one of the Anna Kendrick?
Exactly. In that group. And Ms. Purple is about this sort of estranged brother and sister in LA's Koreatown whose father is kind of on their deathbed, and the brother comes back and they're dealing with it. And it's it has like a very slow burn quality to it, but a lot of flashbacks to their childhood filling in what got them there. And I think it's just really interesting, so well done. It's a limited release, so I'm not sure how many people will get to see it, but keep an eye out for it because I think it's a good view and worth checking out. And I think he's a really interesting talent up and coming. It'll be nice, you know, it's nice to see track people as they go. Yeah. Ms. Purple.
So I didn't see anything it's super exciting recently, which means we get a wild vault pick from your boy. And, you know, since we have a visually stimulating movie like Avatar this week, I'm going to give you an even more visually stimulating movie. Very curious to see what the room thinks about this pick, but I think it was another one of the Wachowskis' Hook, Line, and Sinker, Speed Racer. Speed Racer, baby, was great. I don't know why more of you weren't running to the theaters to see that beautiful, bright world. I came out and the world looked bleak because the world inside the theater was beautiful. It was bright. It was fast. And I mean, you get to hear John Goodman say ninja, more like nanja. Come on, that's that alone should get $1 million.
I remember seeing that movie on the Warner lot and then like walking out to the lobby and staring at a white wall for like 2 minutes because I was like, I couldn't take it.
I love it. It was like the Wachowskis were like, you know that episode of The Simpsons where they show that anime that gives everyone seizures? Like, let's
Mighty Seizure
try
Warriors.
That. Yes! It was like, let's try that. And I
think in my review I said it's like if they melted Skittles and poured them directly into your eyeballs.
But yeah, it just worked for me. I just loved the aesthetic. I was like, you went for it.
It has a fan base.
Yeah. But now it's time for 5-star reviews. If you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, we'll read it on air. there. There are no new podcast reviews this week, so producer Casey had to make one up yet again. Producer Casey sent in, Who Shot Your Podcast is equivalent to the element of carbon, the king of the elements, known since antiquity, and the building block of life. Much like carbon, without this podcast, life for me would cease to exist. So you can just copy and paste that.
Well done, Casey. That was good.
Let that be your guide, listeners.
Yeah, yeah. Come with that heat. Guys, this was fun.
A treat.
A real treat. Thank you. We're having too much fun here. And thank you, Drea, for that dope movie pick.
Yes. You can't tell, but our tails are all intertwined.
If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Your Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/ Who Shot Your Podcast, or send us an email at whoshotya@maximumfun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This has been a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.